Newgate Prison, the most notorious block of lumpen misery ever to put down foundations in old London town. Built on the orders of Harry Plantagenet, way, way back at the last gasp of the 12th century, and refashioned on the say-so of Lord Mayor Dick Whittington himself, which is rarely mentioned in the storybooks. Constructed in accordance with the principles of the French architecture terrible school, with deliberate, heavy repulsiveness, the building itself served as a warning to those who looked upon it of the fate of anyone who would choose a life of crime. The prison contained not a single elegant line, nor a decent patch of natural light. Outside this forbidding structure, flinching at the sounds of diverse wailings from within, stood the boy magician Riley, not yet 15, and his companion Chevron Savano, warrior maiden from the future, and just over 2 years his senior, both thinking thoughts along the lines of, "This place is hell on earth," and, "We must free Tom from here." "Gold will do the job, Chevy," Riley said, with a slight tremor in his voice that only a close friend would notice. "Shillings for killings, and pound letters for debtors. Cash is king in the gate." "Right," said Chevy in the American fashion, and squeezed his fingers. For in this, young Riley was indeed correct. Newgate was every bit as much a financial establishment as Threadneedle's Bank of England. Food, clothing, family quarters, everything was on offer for cash in the prison, up to the striking of a man's fetters from his ankles, or a dram of laudanum to quiet the condemned's nerves on his short walk to the triple gibbet. And the man to be hanged need not be a murderer. There were hundreds of crimes that would get a man or woman invited to dance the Newgate jig. One of these crimes was that of defaultery. London was a city of commerce, and, to many of the local business folk, reneging on one's debts was a crime most heinous. A man who would cheat his neighbours deserved no less than a spot of capital punishment, while his fellow prisoners cheered and jeered. And according to all available information, Tom Riley, known commonly as Ginger, was in debt up to the apple of his soon-to-be stretched neck. Unless the wronged man could be paid off. In that case, it would be all kisses and cuddles. And off you go, Ginger, into a bright new tomorrow. But not so quick, youngster. Not so sprightly. Negotiating this class of deal was trickier than tying a knot in a jelly deal. One party had the other in sight of the rope that would hang him, and it would take a wheedler of real talent to wring any leverage out of that situation, especially when Tom had defrauded a man of stature, namely Sir James Maccoby, the finest attorney in London, with more souls on his account than the Great Fire. Riley could attempt the wheedle himself, but he would be eaten alive by Maccoby, and so he had engaged the services of the famous prison negotiator, Tartan Nancy Grimes, who could have outmaneuvered Bonaparte himself had the wee Frenchman been unlucky enough to have found himself across the barter table. So Tartan Nancy had come, tested the sovereign advance with a grind of her molars, and then promptly disappeared into the bowels of the prison to see what was what, and who was who, and most importantly, how much was enough. And now Chevy and Riley waited for the wheedler to return. They waited, shuffling and uncomfortable, in the teeming shanty town that sprang up in the shadow of Newgate, and was dismantled every month or so by the militia, only to grow again like a winter weed between the flagstones. They waited among the destitute families and the visitors and the hawkers and veterans. They averted their eyes from the human tragedy, clamoring on all sides, for Riley had troubles of his own, and Chevy had not yet convinced herself that any of this was real. "I am in a coma," she told herself repeatedly. "I am in a coma, and this is what I get for reading Charles Dickens late at night." It was a reasonable theory, much more credible, in fact, than the timeline presented to her by this reality. FBI, time machines, magician assassins, megalomaniacal army colonels, and so on. Coma or not, Chevy had agreed to pull on a dress from the Orient Theatre's costume wardrobe, wearing it over her FBI jumpsuit to spare Riley's blushes. She topped off the outfit with a straw bonnet that hid her dark hair and skin so as not to attract more attention. "I must look like Darth Vader's daughter wearing this monstrosity," she had thought at the time. Being the only Shawnee Native American in the entirety of England was stare-worthy enough without being dressed in a fashion shockingly immoral for the period. Or, as Riley had put it, "We got us plenty of eyes on storks without you parading yourself like a slattern."